Hello, everyone, and welcome to another insightful expert interview at the Innovation and Creativity Summit 2017. Very happy to have a friend of mine, David Burkus, with us today. David is an author of multiple best-selling books, including the new one, Under New Management, and the one that I got to know him from, The Myths of Creativity. And he's also a professor at Oral Roberts University, expert in innovation and creativity, and I'm very happy to have you here today, David.
Oh, no, thank you. I'm excited to be here. And thank you for reaching out. I don't know how many years ago that was when we started to get to know each other after Myths came out. So it's been great.
Absolutely. So for people who don't know you or the sort of work that you've done, can you just give us a brief insight into how you got into insights around creativity and innovation?
Yeah. So my goal with all of my writing, all of my speaking, all of my work is to make good ideas easier to use, basically, to take. And when I say good ideas, I usually mean evidence-based, empirically researched, lots of science behind the idea, and to make those easier to use, because a lot of times those hang out in the ivory tower and we don't really know about them. And, you know, we owe a debt of gratitude to people like Malcolm Gladwell and places like TED, but there's a whole lot more good ideas trapped in the ivory tower that we want to sort of escape. And one of the first places that I was sort of motivated to attack that was in and around creativity and innovation, mostly because there are so many best practices, so many things that people do that are elevated to the level that they're almost unquestionable and also have no science to support them, right? So that was the goal of sort of, okay, well, here's what the research actually says, and it's bad news for a lot of these faulty beliefs about how creativity is supposed to work.
I know, it's something I found doing a lot of the other expert interviews at the summit. When you actually speak to the people who are editing the journals, researching creativity, who are doing the research on the ground, you're finding a lot of counterintuitive evidence come up, which really goes against what people expect to be the norm, just because it feels like what best practice should feel like.
Yeah, I mean, and you bring up a really, you use an interesting word that I think stems from a lot of this problem is feels, right? We are, in scientific terms, we're a sample size of one, right? So there's how we feel something went. And we have mostly our own experiences to go on. If it felt good, if it felt bad, et cetera, then we reflect on that and sort of tell ourselves a story about why it felt that way. The interesting thing is that often we don't have the benefit of knowing whether or not that was even successful, right? So we did it, and we, after the fact, feel like it worked out okay, but that doesn't necessarily mean it did. It's going to take a number of years after we've done the thing to know if that was the best thing or not. And also, we have no comparison. We can't, whenever you make a decision, it's not like there's another one of you that makes the opposite decision and then you go off and you can compare a year later who has the better life outcome, right? You can do that in scientific research. You have a control group and a regular group or an intervention group. And then you can actually compare and contrast the differences and see what works well, not because it feels like it worked, but because it actually did work better. And that's where a lot of the things that we're relying on feeling and reflective storytelling to explain fall away because they're based on feeling.
I think that's why you and I are such kindred spirits in a lot of ways. We both want this evidence behind what we're talking about. So that's why I'm excited to have another chat with you today about some things that people can actually get some firmer grip on when it comes to understanding how creativity and innovation actually work. So let's get started, and let's talk about some of the things you've written about in your books. We've covered quite a few of them around the other talks in the summit, but one which we haven't touched on, amongst others, is a lot of people feel like there's a certain type of breed of type of person who is much better at coming up with ideas, and these are the people who you should leave the creativity to in a business. What's your view on that?
Yeah, well, there's not a lot of evidence to support that, right? So this, I mean, to me, this stems from, it's twofold. It stems from our natural desire to sort of apply genetics to everything, right? Ever since we discovered DNA, we've been wanting to figure out what's genetic and what's not, what's nature and what's nurture. Some of it actually goes before that. I mean, you look at Sir Francis Galton, who had this book, Hereditary Genius, that was all about trying to figure out where does genius come from? Is it genetic? And, you know, it was an interesting idea. It was a little weird because everyone who was a genius in Sir Francis Galton's study was a wealthy white male living in England. But, okay, you know. and ever since then, we've been trying to see, is there this sort of genetic component? And the truth of the science is that nature has yet to eliminate the role of nurture, right? So there is some evidence. The way that I like to say is, in the same way that if you are tall, really tall, you have a better than average chance of making the NBA than, you know, if you're 5'1", right? Or I don't actually know what that is in meters. My apologies. And in the same way, you know, if you're tone deaf, you're going to have a much harder time becoming a genius composer or musician. And so there are certain genetic predispositions, for sure. We know that. The best way to think of it is it sort of sets a range. And then after that, it's what you do inside that range. The thing about that is that everybody has the potential to move up in that range. I've never met somebody who has achieved the peak of their creative ability, right? I think everybody can move up in that range. I have no idea what the top of that range is for anybody, but most people can move up in it. The other thing that sort of compounds that organizationally is we've started to apply this term creative to certain roles, not even as an adjective anymore, as a noun. These are the creative industries, it's the adjective, and then people start calling themselves, I'm a creative. And it sends a subtle message that if you're not in one of those roles, if you're not in that box in the org chart, then your role doesn't require creativity, it doesn't require innovation, it doesn't require an ability to solve problems. And that's simply not true, especially in 2017. The majority of the work that's being done in the industrialized world, in the knowledge work era, is work that involves solving problems. What's the fundamental component of solving problems? Creativity, right? So every role is that, and yet we sort of wrongly associate it with certain boxes. And the truth is, I think a lot of us do it to let ourselves off the hook. You know, creativity is inherently risky, it's dangerous, it's uncomfortable, sometimes it doesn't feel right, to go back to our prior point. And so if we can just say, oh, well, I'm not creative, right? I can't draw, therefore I'm not creative. By the way, I can't draw, but I can write, right? So there goes that argument. But if we do that, most of the time we're doing it to let ourselves off the hook so that we don't have to try to begin with. And we can hide in certain roles in the organization and say, these things are never going to need my creativity. And that's just faulty. In 2017, in the business environment that we're in, we need almost everybody's brain to help us solve the problems that we need to solve in order to move forward as an organization.
Absolutely. There's a lot of studies and surveys which have gone around very senior leadership levels over the last couple of years, asking what's going to be important for your company in the future. And creativity is becoming more and more and more sought after in a corporate setting. In fact, I think that in 2010 or so, IBM interviewed 1,500 CEOs, and creativity was the number one thing they said they needed for the future. And yet they're still doing things unconsciously, these CEOs and people in leadership levels, which they don't realize are hampering people's creativity in the actual businesses that they're trying to help. So let's talk about that for a while. What sort of things are companies doing which are unknowingly hurting people's creativity?
Yeah, well, so there's a couple things if you want to go into the unknowing category. There's the sort of direct and indirect influences, right? So indirect influences, as I talked about earlier, are things like the organizational chart, the way that we assign certain tasks, this belief that creativity only comes from certain departments, marketing and sales and engineering and R&D, for example, but that creativity can't come from accounting. I mean, I guess it can. We all remember what happened with Enron, and that was pretty creative. But we could use that same creative ability towards good ends as well. So letting that sort of org chart shape who is, that's an indirect influence. The other thing that the org chart often does is it sort of defines who our relationships are. So we have this subtle tendency to associate with and be around mostly the people that are in our department or are in our leg of the giant pyramidal chart. And so information doesn't flow through the whole organization to the level that it really should to optimize everybody's creativity. So that's kind of another indirect influences. From a senior leader perspective, there's a lot of direct influences as well. I mean, one of the biggest challenges is that as things move up in organization, they move up in organization because they're more difficult problems to solve. You know, I can remember our former president, Barack Obama, had this quote that I loved and applies to every CEO, every small business owner, anybody who's ever been the top person in an organization. So the things that land on my desk are problems nobody else can solve, right? That's why they got there. If they could have been solved at a different level, then they wouldn't get there. And the challenge is that in evaluating those solutions, in coming up with here's the problem, here's what we have to decide, et cetera, leaders are put into this role where they're also tasked with judging people's solutions. And the way that they respond to that can really send a message as to whether or not they actually want creative thinking and innovative thinking or not. So we're all familiar with being told that we want to people to think outside the box, but a lot of us are familiar with being rejected because we thought outside the box, right? And I know that you're an admirer of the work of Jennifer Mueller, and I think she's another speaker on the summit on the kind of the larger implications for this. But even in just the language that we use when we're accepting or rejecting an idea, we can have a direct influence on whether or not our people decide their creative ability is welcome. And creativity is like a muscle. If we don't allow our people to keep using it, it falls into atrophy. And they become more likely to believe lies like, I'm not creative.
I mean, it's interesting you say you should use it like a muscle, because it's an analogy that I use when I'm speaking with clients who say, I'm not creative. And I ask them, if you were to go to the gym a couple of times, would that improve your muscle fitness? And would that improve your health? And it's a very similar mindset that if people say, I'm not fit because I'm not as fit as the guys in the NBA or playing Premier League soccer or in the Olympics, that doesn't mean that you can't become fitter if you work at it. And it's the same as if you're comparing yourself to Picasso or Beyonce or Steve Jobs or Elon Musk. Just because you're not at that level right now doesn't mean that you can't improve your ability by working at it.
Right, exactly. And also doesn't mean that, you know, that you're supposed to. If you put those people on a pedestal and you define that as the entry, you know, the price of admission for who gets classified as creative, then you're probably looking for an out. You're setting yourself up to fail so that you don't have to exercise that muscle at all, right? So it's sort of to use your analogy, it's sort of the equivalent of saying, well, I'm never going to be able to play in the NBA, so I might as well never work out and never try, right? And, you know, I guess you could do that. You're going to have a very short, very depressing life, but you'll probably watch everything that's available on Netflix. and creativity is kind of the same way. If you're going to say that I need to have Elon Musk level creativity to be any good, well, then your organization can't use you because you're not going to allow it to use you. But your organization just needs you to make your contribution and then everybody else to make their contribution. And collectively, we as a whole organization can be far more creative than Elon himself or Thomas Edison himself or whomever, Steve Jobs, pick whoever you want, you know, these people on a pedestal. Multiple minds all contributing their part are going to go further than that one person's creativity.
Absolutely. A lot of people forget that even Thomas Edison and Elon Musk and Steve Jobs, they didn't do all of the invention themselves. They had huge teams of smart people, hardworking people behind them who helped them achieve these things.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I say it often, creativity is a team sport, and we forget that. And, you know, at least, you know, I'm an American, so we have this tendency in all of our media, even in sports, to associate to the one instead of to the entirety of the team. And we apply the same thing to business. As soon as you make your dent in the universe, the world tends to forget all of the people that helped you get enough momentum to make that dent.
Let's talk about something else then, which is this concept of what makes up a good idea. So a lot of people think that if you're going to come up with something new, it needs to be fundamentally different from anything that's come before. But sometimes the best ideas are the ones that are just slight tweaks on something which was nearly there previously.
Yeah, I mean, again, we have this idea of setting the pedestal too high, right? So if your pedestal is, or if your price of admission or your admissions criteria is a wholly original idea, what, for one, you're going to set yourself up for failure because there's no such thing as a wholly original idea. Ex nihilo creation is kind of outside the realm of mere mortals, right? And therefore, all ideas are combinations of pre-existing ideas. No matter what, you're going to borrow an influence from somebody else. This is somewhere actually where artists and musicians are usually a little bit more intellectually honest than a lot of engineers or individuals in a business capacity thinking about creativity. Because if you ask a musician, who are your influences, what you're literally asking them are, who are the people that you listen to so often and copied from in the process of finding your unique sound, right? And that's all creative ideas. They're combinations of pre-existing idea. So if you're setting that as your admissions criteria, you're already setting yourself up to failure. You might be doing it to give yourself an out. You might just not know. But then the other thing to your point is that some of the starting places for coming up with the best ideas should be the old ideas, the discarded ideas. Most often, I mean, I'm a big fan of the design thinking methodologies, and they talk about the idea that it's an iterative process. You start with a minimum viable product, prototype, you start with something small, you iterate, you iterate, you iterate, you eventually arrive at that thing. Now, each iteration is just a process of adding a new idea or a new tweak to an older idea. Usually that first prototype even starts from something else, right? And if we look at, to go back to all of these people that we put on pedestals, Elon Musk was not the first person to try and create an electric car. He certainly wasn't the first person to try and go to space, right? Steve Jobs wasn't the first person to create a smartphone. In fact, wasn't the first Apple product that looked like a small handheld smart device, right? They tried it once before and learned a lot of lessons in the process of their failure that then they could fix when the technology was better. In the same way, Thomas Edison's patent on lights is actually called Improvements in Electric Lights because he was the 22nd or 23rd, I always forget, person to file a patent on electric light bulbs, right? He was playing around with other people's ideas and making improvements to them, and he became the one, really what he gets credit for is becoming the one that unlocked the right combination that scaled. But we have to understand that he would have never done that if there weren't the 20-something people before him who were experimenting with combinations as well.
So let's talk about this concept of expertise. What does expertise play in creativity and being able to execute those ideas?
So expertise is a tricky thing then, right? Because Edison, for example, needs to know enough about previous work to be able to have raw material to copy from. The challenge is that if you look at the entirety of a creative process, working in teams or working as an individual, you have this sort of idea generation, you're creating the prototype, you're getting feedback, et cetera. But every time you come up with an idea, there's a judgment phase in every creative process. You have to decide, am I going to elaborate on this? Am I going to build this? Or is this a failure, right? You have to try thousands of things, right? Or I don't remember. The Smithsonian, I think, says it was only 600 filaments. But, you know, he said tens of thousands. Great marketer, by the way. A lot to learn there. But so you have to try a bunch of things, and you have to judge whether or not they were successes or failures. In that moment of judgment, expertise can actually be more damaging than it is helpful. So expertise can help you on the front end. But on the back end, when you're trying to decide whether or not you invest the time to keep going with this idea, it turns out expertise can actually be sort of a bad thing. And this is just a quirk of human nature, right? When we see a problem, one of the things we naturally do is we make analogies back to similar problems we've worked on. So we come up with a solution to a certain problem, and our mind goes back to similar solutions to similar problems. And most often than not, we come up with false negatives. Right? So there's a saying in physics, for example, that if you don't do Nobel Prize winning work by the time you're 30, you should just retire. And I think it's a really curious phrase because it's essentially saying that after 30, you're not going to come up with that idea. You are. What tends to happen is that after 30, you have so many past failures that you're associating with this new idea, you decide it's not even worth trying. Like those young, late 20, early 30-something physicists, they have just as many crazy ideas as the people with tons of experience. The difference is they have a lot of time and not a lot of past experience of failure, so they try stuff. And they waste a lot of time, but eventually they stumble into the thing that gets them the Nobel Prize, right? A similar thing happens in medicine. After I wrote Myths of Creativity, which I'm still kind of weirded out by, my wife, when she finally read the book like 6 months after, said, oh, you should have included the story of H. pylori and ulcers. And I was like, wait, what? Why didn't you tell me this when I was writing the book? But essentially, similar things happen in medicine. So we discovered that ulcers are not necessarily caused by stress and high acidity levels in the stomach. They're caused by a bacteria. We discovered that because two people came up with the theory, presented it to the medical community. They said, you're crazy. We've already solved this problem. No need to continue. Their expertise blocked them from seeing the solution. So one of the two medical doctors swallowed a vial of the bacteria and then photographed his stomach as he developed an ulcer, right? And present these new findings to the medical community. Of course, they say, you're still crazy, but thanks for doing the experiment for us because now we know, right? So it happens often in that expertise can certainly help you come up with new combinations, but it can also kind of frame the way that you are going to judge the value of investing in those new ideas. And you're going to tend towards false negatives a whole lot more than reality actually dictates.
What seems to happen, though, is it's not just in these scientific communities and musicians and artists, it's CEOs and business leaders as well, who have this experience of how the companies run up until that point. And that's how this is how we do things here is quite right. Often one of the most dangerous phrases you can hear when it comes to innovation.
Right. This idea can't work because it's different than how we do things. Well, wait a minute. If how you do things was working and was the only way to work, then you wouldn't need out of the box thinking to begin with, right? So if the way we did things around here was working, nobody would need creativity anyway, right? And there are legitimately some industries in which we haven't seen major innovation for hundreds of years, and we don't need to because they have pretty simple problems. But there's a lot of industries that have wicked problems that are incredibly difficult to solve and are only going to be solved doing something different than the way we do things around here.
So let's talk about another thing which is related to getting the best ideas. And again, it goes against what's considered common knowledge. It's this idea of criticism and giving feedback on ideas during the process. A lot of people feel like if you criticize an idea, people are just going to turn into wallflowers and put their hands up and say, I don't want to participate anymore. But what's your view on it?
Right. And so you speak to the exact fear, right? So decades ago, a gentleman by the name of Alex Osborne really wrote probably the first creativity manual. He wrote a book called Applied Imagination, and it was all about the things that his advertising firm and his colleagues in the firm did to stimulate their creativity. Now, this is like the Mad Men era, which we tend to associate with all these amazing ad campaigns. The truth is most of them weren't all that creative. People were just so, advertising was so new that any ad campaign would work really, really well, right? But we took his advice. So we read this book, Applied Imagination. It has this new technique called brainstorming in it, right? Brainstorming has four rules. Nobody remembers what all four are anymore, but they remember that one of them is to defer judgment. No idea is a bad idea. You're not allowed to criticize because, just like you said, the fear is that when there's criticism in the room, people will self-censor out of fear of that criticism. And while that may be true, it turns out that the more damaging thing is that there's no criticism because then we're stuck with just the ideas that people generate individually, right? The truth is that when you push back on somebody's idea, when you question it, when you ask a why on it, and they have to defend it, collectively, the two of you or the entirety of the room now work towards a stronger, better quality idea. We've seen this in the research. Probably the best study is a study by a woman named Charlene Namath, led by her, a bunch of different colleagues involved, that literally compared traditional four rules of brainstorming to four rules with the criticism one modified so that you push back on every idea as it's generated. The group in that condition not only came up with more ideas right away, came up with more ideas later when they circled back and resurveyed them because their mind was continuing to think about and sort of defend those ideas. So the trick is not how do we avoid all conflict, but how do we stay focused on task-oriented conflict? Because task-oriented conflict is going to actually encourage everyone to think deeply but also more broadly about the idea so that we can strengthen it. We're going to get more and better ideas if we can push back on them, if we can get comfortable with the idea that there's a time and a place for conflict, and we need it in everybody's creative process.
I want to change tack slightly now then, because one of the reasons I was so keen to have you on the summit is you just ran a summit of your own a couple of months ago, which is all about figuring out how to work smarter and more efficiently. And part of that was also about how to get the best types of ideas to bubble to the surface and actually get executed. So can we talk a bit about the sort of myths and preconceptions that people have about how they should work smarter and the sort of insights you've got over the last year or two about what it actually takes to make your ideas happen?
Yeah, so this is an interesting one. So we started this summit and the idea was that we would focus a lot on productivity tips. Right. So how do you get more focus? How do you stop from checking your email after hours or et cetera? And we found that we really had to broaden that, because so much of Work Smarter is also taking an active approach to things that sort of happen accidentally. So we ended up with tracks around how do you interact and collaborate on a team. You know, this conflict one is a really good one. We chase cohesiveness in teams, for example. But the truth is that if you're trying to do more creative work, you need people who care enough about you and care enough about your project to push back on it, right? So that's something that we sort of uncovered. We also kind of found that part of working smarter is treating your career smarter. And I think this is probably the big one I was not expecting, but has really interesting implications for creativity and innovation in particular. So, you know, we talked about earlier this idea that org charts kind of have this indirect influence on people. They tend to hang around in just their little area and create silos and clusters. And one of the predominant social scientists of the last several decades is a gentleman named Ronald Burt. He came up with this idea, the theory of structural holes. And essentially, a structural hole is someone or some, well, a structural hole is the gap between two different sort of clusters in an organization, two different legs in the org chart, two different departments that never talk to each other, et cetera. And when someone can be a broker and fill that gap, fill that structural hole, Burt actually says it in a beautiful way, that he says they're at a higher probability of stumbling upon good ideas, right? So they run the danger of finding great ideas much more often because they're in that structural hole. Now, how do you become that type of person? Well, you've got to take a pretty active role in your career and map out. Clearly, I can't just sit around and wait for promotions to happen. I have to think about what is the total career path and how do I move more laterally as I'm moving up in an organization, or how do I move from different organizations to the vendor, to the supplier, to other places in the whole network of the industry that I'm in, so that as I build my career, I'm building these connections and bridging structural holes, because those are the people, just by their very nature, that are going to encounter more great ideas that both sides of the gap need, right? So the career one especially was one I wasn't planning on when we went into it. It was funny, it was one of these accidental things, because the book that I'm currently working on sort of deals with a lot of the science behind networks and structural holes and that sort of thing. And it was also in the advice of a lot of these career experts that we had sought out. It's really quite curious.
It's fascinating how that happens. And it's one of the reasons why you want to get interacting with as many different people as possible, because you'll end up just getting these golden nuggets that you weren't expecting coming out of nowhere.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, to the point about, you know, we were talking earlier around originality and the idea that a lot of breakthrough ideas are just adding one little thing to a pre-existing idea. A lot of times, a lot of the disruptive innovations, the things that really shake up an industry or allow for high probability in an organization, are actually taking an idea from one area and bringing it over to a different area. And you can only do that if you have the ability to span that structural hole.
Dave, I'm sure we could keep talking for hours and hours and hours, but we're coming up to the end of the interview. One thing I'd like to ask you, like I ask all the other experts, is if you've got one tip or one, as I say, actionable insight to start getting more value out of your creativity, sort of favorite thing to do that you recommend people do over the course of an afternoon or a week, what would you recommend they try?
So, you know, something you could do really simply and fairly quickly. So you said it afternoon, we could probably do it inside of 30 minutes. Is I would encourage people to email or call or text or reach back to former colleagues. So we just talked about the structural holes, that whole idea. The truth is your career probably already has some of them that you're allowing to be a hole, even though you have prior relationships in that company, that industry, et cetera. And your former colleagues are far more valuable than you think, because in reaching back to them, it doesn't take as much work as meeting new people, because you already have a pre-existing relationship. But by not keeping in touch with them every once in a while, you're not allowing them to influence you, you to influence them, and to take advantage of all of those things we were going to talk about. So yeah, make a list of about five people that you used to have a strong relationship with, but because you moved on or they moved on or whatever happened, you're not talking to very often, and just reach back. No agenda, no advice seeking, no whatever, just trying to reconnect with those people. And you'll find that the benefits of those conversations are far more valuable than you think.
I like that one. I might try that out on LinkedIn this week. Right, David, it's been absolutely wonderful having you here. We're going to get links down to your resources below the video here. Can you just let people know what sort of things they can find if they go there?
Yeah, so we've developed a lot of stuff around the midst of creativity, around under new management. It's actually kind of cool right now because I'm in the midst of writing this new book and we're kicking out a couple different resources, not unlike that former colleagues thing. We're kicking out a couple different resources designed to be sort of helpful for people. A lot of them are activity sheets, templates, short articles that you can read, et cetera. And they're all there at davidberkus.com/resources. And they're categorized by what you're looking for. So if you want creativity, it's there. If you want leadership and management, it's there. If you want networking, it's there. So you can kind of pick whatever you're looking for.
Dave, it's been wonderful having you here. Thanks so much again for being part of the summit. And yeah, I look forward to speaking again with you soon.
Yeah, thank you again so much for having me.
Congratulations on being part of the Innovation and Creativity Summit. I'm sure that if you continue to watch the other expert interviews, you will experience an improvement in your capability to turn your ideas into something valuable. But don't forget, to get the very best experience and ensure you don't miss any of the priceless lessons, you should invest in yourself with the All Access Pass. Not only will this give you exclusive lifetime access to watch all the lessons whenever is best for you, you will also get all the interviews as downloadable audio files so you can learn on the go, full transcripts so you can read and analyze the great advice and tips, and exclusive bonuses not available to anyone else. Click the link below to get your All Access Pass now.